Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Economics 101 when we come back. You know, Joe Smith started the day early, having set his alarm clock made in Japan for 6 a.m. And while his coffee pot, made in Japan, is perking, he puts his blow dryer, made in Taiwan, to work, and then shaves with his electric razor, made in Hong Kong. He puts on a dress shirt made in Taiwan, his designer jeans made in Singapore, and a pair of tennis shoes made in Korea. Then, after making up some breakfast in his new electric skillet, made in the Philippines, he sits down to figure out on his calculator, made in Mexico, how much he can spend today. After setting his watch, made in Switzerland, to the radio, made in Hong Kong, he goes out and gets in his car, made in Germany, and goes looking, as he has been for months, for a good-paying American job. Then, after the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals made in Brazil, pours himself a glass of wine made in France, turns on his TV made in Japan, and then ponders again why it is that he cannot find a good-paying American job. Well, instead of a good-paying American job, why doesn't Joe look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? Now, if you'd like to tap into this power of private business, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free. And you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email, or better yet, click on to the archives page. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there in the privacy of your own home. How's that for a deal? All right, we're talking about the fundamentals of economics. The reason I thought I would tell you this story is because my wife went over to the health food store, and the lady in the health food store asked her what deflation was all about. Or in this case, it's the redoing of the money supply. It's giving us Ameros in place of our dollars. What's going to happen is that there is a time on the horizon, probably coming this year in 2010, when our government's going to go bankrupt. They're not going to be able to meet their obligations. And when that time comes, then they have to change the currency. They've got a default. Now, governments go bankrupt. They just do it a little differently than you and I do. When we go bankrupt, we run down, we file a petition with the court, and we're asking them to absolve us of our debts. Well, in the case of nations, what they do is they devalue their currencies. Now, we owe the Chinese, $750 billion, and so we'll just devalue our currency by half, and that'll cut our debt to them in half. They'll get screwed for half of what we owe them. They went out and worked, and they produced, and they thought they were going to get $750 billion, but they're really only going to get $375. Now, that's what we're going to do to them. You Canadians up there, we owe you a bunch of money, so we're going to stiff you for about half of it. That's what it boils down to. And when that lady didn't understand those terms, I got to thinking about that. I said, well, hell, most Americans don't. That's why we're in the pickle that we're in. We keep voting the same people back into office and have been for the last 100 years. And we've been following a lot of fallacious economic theory. It came from a guy named John Maynard Keynes. And it's flawed economic theory, but Keynes didn't dream it up. It's been around for thousands of years. It's the idea that you can get something for nothing and that there's a free lunch. And all we do is we dress it up a little differently with each generation and pass it off, and then we change it and we dress it up and give it some new words and pass it off. It's been going on forever. And it's going to continue going on forever because it's popular. It fits in with human nature. It fits with vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. And those that follow these pernicious ways end up poor. They end up getting wiped out. There's not much I can do to help them. I mean, it's not that I'm going to solve your problem and come in like a knight on a big white horse and pay your mortgage off or something like that. A lot of times people will call the law school and they want me to help them. They want me to solve their problems. What they're really saying in effect is, I'm tired of my master in Washington, D.C., and I'm looking for a new master. Here at the law school, we're not interested in a guardian-ward relationship. We're educators here. I want to show you, here's what caused your problem, and here's the way to solve it. Now, you go solve your problem. Don't ask me to do it for you. You go do it for yourself. Now, there isn't any problem out there that's insoluble. People call here, and they're mainly concerned about their houses. Then they say, oh, I'm about to lose my house. I'm going to take my house. I can't make my payments. Okay. And let's suppose you got a $200,000 house. You got $100,000 equity in the house. And you're making $2,000 a month payments. The best thing in the world that can happen to you is that the bank takes your house and absolves you of the $100,000 debt. They're doing you a favor, Bob. And of course, Bob calls here and he's crying and he says, oh God, save my home, save my house. And it's the American dream. It's a fallacy. It's nonsense. So here at the law school, when we do a business school, we start out by showing people how to build their own house and do it for about 25% of that $200,000. For instance, if you've got a $200,000 house, I'll show you how to build that house in 36 months, and you can pay for it all cash and own it free and clear for about $50,000. Wouldn't that be a hell of a deal? And if you haven't got that kind of money, well, let's cut that down to a $100,000 house and let's build it for $25,000, because the actual cash out of pocket is about 25% of the market price of the house. And I'm an old-timey general contractor, and my thinking is that instead of buying a house for $200,000 and then paying for that thing over the next 30 years, and if you're successful, you'll buy one for you and two for the banker. You're gonna buy three houses. You're gonna spend your labor and the equivalent of three houses worth of labor, and you're gonna get one of them. The banker's gonna get the other two. Why don't we do it a little differently? Why don't we use a different formula over the next 30 years, and let's build the same three houses, and let's keep all three of them for you, Bob, so that when you get through, you got three houses for you and none for the banker. I know it's selfish. I know it's all one-sided, and the poor banker is probably going to starve to death, but, you know, let him go out and take care of himself. The bankers are not taking care of you. They're taking care of themselves. And they're feeding off of the public trough. And that's what these bailouts are all about. Now, if you want to bail the bankers out, I don't want to get in your way. God forbid that I'd want to stop you people from bailing out the economy. But I took a look at it and I said, you know, there's a lot of fallacies running around out here. And one of them is dealing with this thing called public works. Public works. And in Hazlitt's book, he's got a chapter here called Public Works Means Taxes. Now, the government is spending money, and they're creating public works like WPA and CCC, and they're building bridges, and they're doing all these great things. And everybody's in favor of that. Republicans, Democrats. And it's a fallacy, and it's bad public policy. it isn't that I'm trying to get you people to vote against it or to stop it. I'm not going to stop it. It's going to go on. I'm just not going to participate in it and impoverish myself in the process. If you want to participate in it and impoverish yourself in the process, that's your choice. Get after it. So I thought, well, let me tell you what the fallacy is. And then you just use your own head and your own good common sense and your own good judgment and decide for yourself, is this beneficial for me and do I want to do this? And if you do, get after it. And if you don't, get off. You know, this is the place to get off this train. Now remember, this is Henry Hazlitt's book, wrote it in 1946, called Economics in One Lesson. This is the 50th anniversary issue. And dynamite book, simple, straightforward. Just plain common sense, and you don't have to be real smart to figure this out. If your IQ is 80, you know, if it's on the north side of 80, I think you'd be a little better off. If it's on the south side of 80, maybe this isn't the book for you. Public Works Means Taxes, Chapter 4. There's no more persistent and influential faith in the world today than the faith in government spending. The faith in government spending. Came upon us in 1933 with Franklin D. Roosevelt. God love him. Everybody in America loves Franklin. And I just wanted to tell you that this whole concept of government spending is a fallacy. It's a dream. Didn't work then. Doesn't work now. It's never worked in history, and it is never going to work in the future. It does have effects, and it does buy votes. And it makes people feel real good, and then people are going to keep after it, and they're going to keep on doing it. They're not going to change. Now, a few of us took a look at this, and when we saw the fallacy, we said, well, gee, that doesn't benefit me, so I think I'll back off. I think I'll get off that train. Now, this thing does benefit a lot of people. It benefits Bank of America. It benefits Kit Bond, politicians, President Obama. I mean, there's millions of people out there going to benefit from this. And that's why they're busily selling it to all the rest of us. So it isn't that there aren't people out there that make a lot of money off of government spending, because they do. But in the long run, most of the people lose their money. It's kind of like the lottery. Now, I'm not opposed to the lottery, so don't get me wrong here. I have never bought a lottery ticket. And if I live to be 110 years old, I'm not ever going to buy a lottery ticket. Now, I know there are millions of dollars to be made buying lottery tickets. And there are people out there that are making millions and millions of dollars buying lottery tickets. There are a lot of people that benefit from the lottery. But for every person who wins the lottery, there's 84 million people that didn't. And so I look at the odds of 84 million to one, and I say, this is not the program for me. Now, it doesn't mean it's not the program for public schools and public school administrators and government and bureaucrats and of course, the few winners of the lottery that actually score. But in order for those people to win, 84 million people all have to lose a dollar in order for one guy to win. You know, that's just the way the game is played. And so the theory is, well, 84 million people aren't going to miss a dollar, and the one guy that wins $60 million is going to feel real good. And the $20 million that goes to administration employs a lot of people, and it buys a lot of public school books and so on, so it benefits a lot of people. That's true. There's 84 million losers for every winner. That's the bottom line. And the 84 million losers are small-time losers. I don't deny that. But 84 million people with $1 is $84 million. And that's $84 million that could have been spent into the economy to buy things that people really want, need, and could use that would benefit everybody, as opposed to the few. But, again, you know, the few people that are benefiting, they have to live too, and so ticks and parasites have to have a host. And that's what public works is all about. Public Works is a parasite that has to live off of all of the taxpayers. All of us have to pay a little bit in so that a few people can score big. And I'm not opposed to you people that are scoring big off of Public Works. I wouldn't deny you your opportunity. I'm just sitting here saying that I'm not gonna participate in the program. I'm not going to send you my $10 so that you can benefit off of me. You're going to have to get out and scramble just like I do. Now, there's a persistent, influential faith in the world called government spending. Everywhere government spending is presented as a panacea for all of our economic ills. Is private industry partially stagnant? Well, we can fix it, and we can fix it with government spending. Is there unemployment? That's obvious due to insufficient private purchasing power. So the remedy is just as obvious. All that's necessary is for the government to spend enough to make up the deficiency. And economics literature is based on this fallacy. And as so often happens with doctrines of this sort, it has become part of an intricate network of fallacies that mutually support one another. We cannot explore the whole network at this point in time, but we will return to other branches of it later. But we can examine here the mother fallacy that has given birth to this progeny. The main stem of the network is government spending, big government spending. Now, of course, the opposite of that is small, limited government. The free enterprise system with a small, limited government produced the wealthiest, most powerful, prosperous, prestigious, political, economic, and military power in the world in 100 years. And it's done it several times in the past. Now we have this gigantic, monolithic government that is imploding upon itself. It's been around for about 100 years, since about 1900. And in just about the same period of time, just a little over 100 years, it has destroyed itself. Just like all of the great and major empires of the past, they've all destroyed themselves. And they all destroy themselves from within. It's not some humongous power from out or outside that comes in here and destroyed the Roman Empire. It disintegrated from within. Just like the great American Empire is disintegrating in front of your eyeballs today from within. There's a cause and effect relationship here. Now, everything that we get outside of the free gifts of nature must be in some way paid for. The world is full of so-called economists who in turn are full of schemes for getting something for nothing. They tell us that the government can spend and spend without taxing at all. That is, can continue to pile up debt without ever having to pay it off because we owe it to ourselves. We'll return to such extraordinary doctrines at a later point in our discussion here, but here I'm afraid that we shall have to be dogmatic and point out that such pleasant dreams in the past have always been shattered by national insolvency or runaway inflation. And here we'll have to say simply that all government expenditures must eventually be paid out of the proceeds of taxation. And that inflation itself is merely a form and a particularly vicious form of taxation. So, as inflation from 1960 to 2000 averaged 4.3%, in the period of time from 1960 to 2000, in that 40-year period, you paid 4.5% of everything you created and produced in tax, called inflation. Now, you can write the check and pay it on April the 15th, or you can just pay it little by little, innocuously, at the gas pump for rising prices of gas, or at the grocery store for the rising price of groceries. Between 1930 and today, the purchasing power of your dollar has lost 98%. So you've been taxed 98% of all of your wealth is gone. It's been spent. Never to return again. I hope that you got all of the things that you wanted for that 98%. If you did, hell, life is grand, you know, everything's fine. But if you didn't get the things that you really wanted and needed and could use, well, maybe you squandered your money. Maybe it was spent inadvisedly. Now, if your Uncle Louis sent you or left you $5,000 in his will, let's say, and you and your wife are sitting at the kitchen table and you're mulling it over and saying, well, gee, how are we going to spend Uncle Louis's $5,000? It's a free gift. It isn't anything that you worked for. It's no skin off your back. There's no sweat off the end of your nose that produced that $5,000. But, you know, you may decide to recarpet the house. That would be a pretty neat expenditure. Would you enjoy having new carpet in the house? Or maybe you'd like to take a princess cruise. Maybe you'd like to take off, you know, for a couple of months and go around the world and just kind of kick back and spend the $5,000 that way. Maybe you'd like to landscape the backyard. Spend it on plants and trees and things like that. I mean, these are choices that people make in life. This is what we spend our money on. This is why we work. This is why we produce. We decide that this is what we want to do in order to spend our money. Now, government comes in here and they spend our money for us. And so when government is spending money, remember, they're spending your money. So when Barack Obama comes up here and he says, well, what we need to do is to come up with a new TARP stimulus program and spend this money out here and employ people, what he's saying is that we're going to hire a bunch of people over here and we want you to pay their salaries for them every Friday. That's the net effect of this government spending. We want you to pay for this. Now, they never tell you that, but that's what the bottom line is. That's where we're headed. Now, a certain amount of public spending is necessary to perform essential government functions. And a certain amount of public works of streets and roads and bridges and tunnels and armories and navy yards and buildings to house legislatures and police and fire departments is in fact necessary to supply the essential public services to protect all of us in our endeavors to produce all of that wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil that comes out of our mining, fishing, farming, and forestry. Because if we didn't have the police there, and I'm not down on you policemen at all, not at all. If we didn't have you policemen there, I would go out and work, and some other guy would come along and steal it from me or take it away from me. So I have to have the policemen there to keep those people at bay to protect me so that I can produce. So I have to give 10% of what I produce to the policemen to protect me so I can keep the other 90%. If I didn't have the policemen there, the guy would come in here and take 100% of it from me. So in my own self-interest, I say better to pay the policemen 10% of everything I create and produce than to leave it out there for the criminal to take all of it. Now, with such public works, the people that are building the bridges and the highways, you know, I've got to get my wheat to market, so I've got to have a road. This is what an integrated vertical economy is all about. And it works like a shot. This division of labor in a free market, God, it just works miracles. Everybody in the world is bedazzled by America and Canada and Australia. You know, they look at us and they say, how in the hell do you people do that? And the people in America, Canada, and Australia haven't got a clue. But your forefathers did, and it was called the free market economy, supply and demand, hard money, gold and silver coin. We all practiced it until about 1930. And then we all jumped the tracks of sanity and went off on this socialist binge like the prodigal son, and we've been squandering everything that we have had, or ever going to have, and we've succeeded. We've squandered it all. Now, I'm not concerned here, and I'm not here concerned with public works considered as a means of providing employment or of adding wealth to the community that it would not otherwise have had. A bridge is built, and if it's built to meet an insistent public demand, if it solves a traffic problem or a transportation problem otherwise insoluble. If, in short, it is even more necessary to the taxpayers collectively than the things for which they would have individually spent their money. Had it not been taxed away from them, then there can be no objection. But a bridge built primarily to provide employment is a different kind of bridge. And when providing employment becomes the end, need becomes a substitute consideration. Projects have to be invented. Instead of thinking only of where bridges must be built, the government spenders begin to ask themselves where bridges can be built. Can they think of plausible reasons why an additional bridge should connect Easton and Weston? It soon becomes absolutely essential. Those who doubt the necessity are dismissed as obstructionists and reactionaries. Well, two arguments are put forward for the bridge, one of which is mainly heard before it is built, the other of which is mainly heard after it has been completed. The first argument is that it will provide employment. It will provide, say, 500 jobs for a year. The implication is that these are jobs that would not otherwise have come into existence. This is what is immediately seen. But if we have trained ourselves to look beyond immediate to secondary consequences, and beyond those who are directly benefited by a government project to others who are indirectly affected, a different picture presents itself. It is true that a particular group of bridge workers may receive more employment than otherwise, but the bridge has to be paid for out of taxes. For every dollar that is spent on the bridge, a dollar will be taken away from taxpayers. If the bridge costs $10 million, the taxpayers will lose $10 million. They will have that much taken away from them, which they would otherwise have spent on things that they needed most. So when we have a public works project, what we're really doing here is letting somebody else decide how we're going to spend our money. If you and I had that $10 million, we probably would not build a bridge. If at the time the Golden Gate Bridge was built, if you would have asked all of the ferry operators if they thought building a bridge across San Francisco Bay was a good idea, they would have said no. It's going to put all of us out of business and destroy hundreds of jobs. You can rest assured that when the building of the Golden Gate Bridge occurred, for the number of people that were employed on it for the 10 years or so that it took to build it, 6 years, I guess, to build it, and the number of people that were impacted on the ferries and all of the attendant losses of employment, that bridge was a boondoggle. Now, as it turns out, that bridge connecting Marin County with San Francisco County has been a tremendous boon. It is to this day. If you take the number of cars driving back and forth across that bridge and the amount of people and houses that have been built and employment that has come from that bridge and all of the collateral benefits that come from it, the number of people that use it to go to and from work, that thing pays for itself every year. It may pay for itself 3 or 4 times every year. That bridge isn't a liability. That bridge is an asset. That thing makes money. It's a benefit. Now, if public money is spent so that it enables me to get my goods to market more efficiently, more effectively, and it makes me a profit, then that bridge is valuable. If, on the other hand, we're just out here digging holes and filling them up, then that isn't doing anybody any good. In fact, it takes the $10 million like breaking the window. All that does is break a window. It's got an immediate effect, and we can see the immediate effect. But that $10 million would do more if it was spent someplace else. Now, write this down because it's pretty important. If you take farming as an enterprise, every dollar that a farmer produces multiplies times 7 in the economy. So for every dollar's worth of corn produced by a corn farmer in Iowa, it produces $7 worth of employment, worth of benefit, worth of profit, as it goes to the miller, as it goes to the corn chip maker, as it goes down the road in a truck, seven times. Now the other three, mining, fishing, and forestry, multiply times five. For every dollar's worth of iron ore that's brought out of the ground, it produces plus $5 worth of employment for steel workers and bridge makers and so on. So when we're working in mining, fishing, farming, and forestry, we are making a profit, and that profit is multiplied in the economy. Now the government comes along and they say, well, we're going to take portions of that and we're going to spend it for you because we're wiser than you are. And we're going to spend that money in a way that is going to benefit this group of people. We're going to put people to work over here. And they do. But that doesn't mean that it's going to multiply or it's going to be beneficial. In some cases it is, but in a lot of cases it isn't. In fact, I'm going to go so far as to say that in most cases it isn't. And so it's a net loss to the economy. When you take my money away from me that I would have spent, like the baker, would have spent that $250 and bought a new suit, we would have had glass, and we would have had a new suit, and we would have had $250 between these three people. As it turns out, we never made the new suit, so we're $250 poorer. That's what the bottom line is. And that's what government spending does when we do it for the purposes of creating jobs. And government's good at that, and I don't deny it. I mean, they're out here just spending money and creating jobs. But for every job they create, they destroy three. When government hires somebody, it takes three people working, paying their taxes to support that guy. So what we're doing is we're unemploying three people over here in the private sector, people that'll never be employed. 65% of all employment comes from little small operations that employ 1 to 100 workers. 25% come from big business. Those are companies that hire 100 workers to many thousands. And then government comes in third. They employ 10% of the workers of America. The biggest boon to our economy is small business, just mom-and-pop operations. It's John's Pizza Shop that employs six or eight people in the pizza store over here on Glenstone Boulevard. That's just one of millions of businesses across America run by little mom-and-pop operations. You know, the guy that's running the gas station over here at the DX station. You know, he's got, probably five employees over there, maybe. Those are the heart and core of the American economy. But our government isn't supporting that segment of the economy. They're supporting the banks and the big corporations. And they're supporting big government that support 35% of the workforce. God love them. It's the 65% of the workforce that's feeding and supplying and taking care of the 35%. So for the 35% of you people in public employment, God, that's great for you. I don't deny it. But it's a big chain around the neck of the other 65% of us. And like the lottery, you got to have 84 people paying a dollar in for the one guy that's going to win the $60 in the lottery when he cashes in his winning ticket. Hey, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's eight schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package, so be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, they're mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Let's take a look at a real live example of what happens when people are buying goods and services or when they're buying products. Here in Ozark County, we don't have any real industry. There's about 10,000 people live in the county. 65% are on Social Security or retired in some other form. About 25% are unemployed, and about 10%, 65 and 25, that makes about 90. About 10% of the people in the county, actually it's more like about 7, are gainfully employed. They run businesses, you know, like resorts or restaurants or hardware stores and things like that. So, if we had a business in the county, let's suppose that we had a school in the county, and the school brought in 100 students a year. Just pick a number. And 100 students come from places like Vancouver, British Columbia, or from Tallahassee, Florida, and Sacramento, California. If those people came to the school in our county, they would bring money with them, wouldn't they? And so a guy's going to come here, let's say, for a week or 2 weeks, and he's in Sacramento, California. He not only has to have his tuition money, but he's also got to have money to spend at the motels and the restaurants. He has to have a car, so he's either going to fly in and rent a car, and he's going to have to buy gasoline. So let's think about all the people here that benefit from just one business, just one school in the county that draws in 100 customers a year. And a customer comes in here and he flies in, typically from California. Sometimes they drive that far, but typically they fly in. So it buys an airline ticket, doesn't it? And so that employs people at the airline. He has to rent a car, so that employs people at Alamo and Hertz and Avis. He has to buy gasoline for the car, so that keeps Mike over here at the DX station pumping gas. And then he has to have a motel room. He has to eat. And then typically when people are here, they'll spend the weekends and they'll go over to Branson, so that provides employment for the people in Branson. And I was asking some of the students, I said, generally speaking, you know, just how much money did you spend when you came out here? Most of these people will spend $1,000. $1,000 here in the local area. So if I brought in 100 people and they all spent $1,000, and that's what most of them, some of them spend more, but nearly all of them have to spend $1,000 to stay here for a week or two. Got it, you know, cost you $250 for the motel, and you got to spend another $250, $300 on food. You got to buy a little gasoline, so $1,000 in the local economy. Now that brought in $100,000 from outside the county that is now spent inside the county. So what happens when Mike over at the DX station gets $100? Well, he spends it over here with Jimmy Wallace. And Jimmy Wallace, when he's got the $100, goes in and spends it at the True Value Hardware store. And the guy in the True Value Hardware store, he spends it over here at Cookies, and Cookies spends it over here. And some guy goes out and buys a new boat, and he puts it in the lake. That's what an economy is all about. That's what happens when people are spending money the way they want to spend it. It circulates around in the local community here. So a business that brings in money from outside is a pretty valuable enterprise. I mean, it's not much for Jimmy Wallace to take $100 and spend it here at the True Value Hardware store. Where'd the $100 come from? Well, it came from the work that somebody produced out in Sacramento, California. Maybe it's a machinist that was working for Lockheed Corporation. And he saved his money and he wanted to go to school. That's what economy is all about. Now, for every public job created by the Bridge Project, a private job has been destroyed somewhere else. And we can see the men employed on the bridge. We can watch them at work. The employment argument of the government spenders becomes vivid and probably for most people convincing. But there are other things that we don't see because, alas, they have never been permitted to come into existence. Those are the jobs that were destroyed by the $10 million taken from the taxpayers. All that has happened at best is that there has been a diversion of jobs because of the project. More bridge builders, fewer automobile workers, television technicians, clothing workers, and farmers. Let me put an arrow here in the margin. Let me tell you a little story. I was working one time in a company called Atlantis Manufacturing Company. And I employed 30 people. And I made furniture. I made water beds and case goods. And those 30 people produced about $100,000 a month, a little over $1 million a year. And this little company, 30 people, was solvent, paid its taxes, about $200,000 a year, paid its labor, about $500,000 a year, and then paid for its materials, which was about, $400,000. And then had a profit left over of about $100,000 a year. So here's a little business making $100,000 a year in profit, paying $500,000 in wages, $200,000 in taxes, $400,000 in lumber and raw materials to make these products and transportation and so on. And it's a pretty going concern. And I'm running it, and I'm happy, and I'm doing my thing. And then I started having problems with OSHA. The government came in, and OSHA wanted to fine me, and they got after me. And then the EPA wanted to come in, and they fined me, and they wanted to get after me. And then the State Tax Commission came in, and they wanted to audit me, and they wanted to fine me, and they wanted to get after me. See? And then one day I got a call from Washington, D.C., The guy said, we're from the Department of Labor in Washington, D.C., and we're coming out to Boise, Idaho, and we want to audit your books. We want to audit your unemployment insurance books. Now, as a small businessman, I was paying about whatever the maximum rate was for unemployment insurance. I think it was around 3%. Well, 0.5% of that goes to the government in Washington, D.C., and the other 2.5% or 3% stays there in Idaho. Now, to come out here from Washington, D.C., this government bureaucrat has to fly on an airplane, come out here, and he's got to stay in a hotel for 10 days. He gets a 10-day audit. What do you think that costs to send a man out here from Washington to audit my books? Well, I estimated that it was going to cost a minimum of $5,000. Airline airline ticket both ways, and his room and board while he's out here, plus his salary and wages, and $5,000. Now remember, my total payroll is $500,000 a year. If you took $500,000 times 0.01, that'd be $5,000. 1%. But the government in Washington doesn't get 1%. They only get 0.5%. That's $2,500. So the government is going to spend twice as much money as they take in a year to come out and audit this little company. Well, when they got through with their audit, the guy said, "You have screwed your employees out of $10,000. And I said, "How so?" And he said, "Well, your employees have overtime. And they're punching in at 7:45, and they're punching out at 4:45, and they're here for 8.5 hours, but they're only getting paid for 8. And you're stealing a half hour a day from them." And I said, "Well, sir, let me explain this to you. My employees work from 8 o'clock until 4:30. They get a half hour off for lunch, so they work from 8 o'clock in the morning, not 7:45, they work from 8. When the bell rings, they go to their workstations. Now they come in at 7:45 or 7:40 or 7:50 or 7:55, and they punch in down here at the office. Then they go up to the third floor where the locker room is located, and then they put their lunch buckets in their locker and change their clothes, smoke a cigarette, and when the bell rings, they go to their workstations. They work until 10 o'clock. At 10 o'clock, they get a 15-minute break, and then at noon, they get a 30-minute break for lunch, and then at 2 o'clock, they get a 15-minute break for a coffee break, and then at 4:30, the bell rings, and they go back to their locker room and change their clothes and smoke a cigarette, and they come down, punch out. None of these people are working any overtime. They're not working 8 hours a day. They're working 7.5 hours a day and getting paid for 8. But we have to have the time clock down here at the office so that we can keep track of it so that it isn't screwed around with. And he said, "Well, the time cards show." And I said, "Well, who complained to you? Who called you and said that they'd been cheated out of their time and a half?" And he said, "Nobody called, but I've done my audit, and that's my findings. And I'm going to give you 90 days to pay these people this $10,000. And if you don't pay them, we're going to fine you that $10,000, and we'll take the $10,000 to Washington." Now, the problem that a little small business like mine has in a circumstance like that is that the employees who left 3 years ago, we don't have any idea where those people are. When somebody leaves his employment, we don't keep track of them. We don't send them Christmas cards and expect them to keep a current name and address on file with us for the next 10 years. So I don't have a clue as to where I'm going to go to find these people to pay them this $10,000 largesse that none of them worked for, none of them got cheated out of, and none of them complained about. But I've got this government bureaucrat, and he's got his procedures. Then he says, "By God, if the time clock is punched at 7:45 and punched out at 4:45, you got to pay that guy time and a half for that half an hour." Now, I took a look at that and I said, "You know, that doesn't make any sense. That's not common sense. That's not reason. That's bureaucracy. That's government." That was the thing that said to me, this thing doesn't work. This truck's broke. So I couldn't quit overnight, but I formulated a plan and I said, I'm gonna close this company down. I'm gonna put this thing out of business. It took me about, that was 1978, it took me until February of 1981, about 3 years, two or three years, to close that thing down. And I closed her down. And I'm happy to report to all of you that the 30 people that used to work there don't work there anymore. That company is defunct. It's out of business. It's closed. Now, I want to tell you that George Gordon is still alive and kicking. And I'm still doing my thing. But I'm doing it without employing 30 people. And I'm doing it without producing $1 million a year. And I'm doing it without paying $200,000 a year in taxes. Thanks to that one bureaucrat from the Department of Labor in Washington, D.C., who opened my eyes to total, stark, raving lunacy. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Mr. Bureaucrat, whoever you were and wherever you are. Because without you, I probably never would have figured out what the hell was wrong. I was one of Tricky Dick's silent majority, just doing my thing and making money and happy as a clam at high tide and hired people and paid them and produced. And one day, a bureaucrat blew into town and said, "You're cheating your employees out of their overtime, and I don't care what your excuse is or what's going on here. This is the way it's going to be." So I said, okay, let's close this thing down. Now, I don't think that my closing that company is a benefit to the 30 employees. It's not a benefit to the United States of America, and it's not a benefit to the economy as a whole. But it was of great benefit to George Gordon, because now I'm happy to report to all of you that I employ no one, produce nothing, and pay no tax. Now, is that really beneficial? Now, let's go on to another part of the story. When we come to the second argument that the bridge exists, it is, let us suppose, a beautiful, and not an ugly bridge, and it has come into being through the magic of government spending. Where would it have been if the obstructionists and the reactionaries had had their way? There would have been no bridge, and the country would have been just that much poorer, one bridge poorer. Well, here again, the government spenders have the better of the argument with all of those who cannot see beyond the immediate range of their physical eyes. It is true, they can see the bridge, but if they have taught themselves to look for the indirect as well as the direct consequences of their actions, they can once more see in the eye of imagination the possibilities that have never been allowed to come into existence. They can see the unbuilt homes, the unmade cars, the washing machines, the unmade dresses and coats, and perhaps the ungrown and unsold foodstuffs. To see these uncreated things requires a kind of imagination that not many people have. We can think of these non-existent objects once, perhaps, but we cannot keep them before our minds as we can the bridge that we pass every working day. That has happened, or what has happened, is merely that one thing has been created instead of others. When we take the $10,000 that the bureaucrat took from me, he opened my eyes and showed me the insanity and the lunacy of what was going on around me. I needed that. That was well worth the $10,000. But here again, if Washington takes the $10,000 and pays the bureaucrat to fly out here and to fly back, it benefited the airline, and it gave this guy a job. He had to have some work to keep him off the streets and out of the pool halls, and it did that. But it took the $10,000 away from me. Now, if I had had that $10,000, I would have bought a new machine. I would have spent that money producing more product. But that product wasn't produced because I didn't have the $10,000. Government decided to take the $10,000 and spend it on something else. But remember, if I had spent that money, I would have multiplied it by 5 times. The bureaucrat, he just took the $10,000 and consumed it upon himself. That's the debility of government employing people. It is true they employ people and they pay them, but it doesn't pay any dividends. Like the man who comes to school here from Sacramento, his money spent into this economy multiplies by five times. But when we send our money to Washington, it's simply consumed and it doesn't produce anything. That's the fallacy of this thing of government spending. But we can't overcome it because the bridge is there for everybody to see. Hell, that Golden Gate Bridge is there for everybody to see. It's been there for 75 years. People drive across it every day. Now, it turns out that the Golden Gate Bridge was a good public works. It employed people building it. It did displace some workers on the ferries. But it created much more work for carpenters and electricians building houses in Marin County so that people who lived in San Francisco could move to Marin County and commute back and forth across the bridge to work. So it's created, over the years, hundreds, maybe thousands of times the cost of its construction. Now that's what we need. That's what's profitable, and I don't deny it. But that isn't where most of the government money's going. It goes to bureaucrats like the one I just described for you. Those guys don't produce anything and they consume much. President Clinton, back in his term, said one time, he said, what we need is 100,000 more policemen out on the streets. That would be like a queen bee in a beehive saying, what we need is 10,000 more guard bees here at the beehive. Excuse me. No, what you need is more guard bees. I don't deny that, but it ain't 100,000. What you need here at the beehive are more workers that are collecting more pollen, making more honey, making more propolis and nectar. Those are the producers. If you need some guard bees to protect you from marauders so that the worker bees can produce more honey, so be it. I don't deny it. But the idea that we'll go out and create 100,000 guard bees is a fallacy. The idea that we're going to go out here and create work by taxing the working productive members of the economy to support those drones is a fallacy. It isn't that we're going to change it, and I didn't come on the air here because I said I'm going to change it or get you to vote for this or that or something else. But I told you what I did. It opened my eyes, and I stopped producing. I stopped producing for the economy, and I started producing for myself. I got off of the socialist kick of one for all and all for one, and got on to the property kick of let's produce real property for me. And then let me produce for you. And then let you produce for you and for me. And back and forth we go in the free marketplace producing for one another the things that we want, the things that we need. And that's dictated by millions of trades, millions of people making their little trades, making their little purchases day in and day out. That's what tells us what's really needed. Not a bureaucrat from Washington. Hey, I'm out of time. I got to give you a reminder here that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated every week and has a radio log schedule and archives. And all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, that's the signal. It says our time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.